Good morning, folks. Welcome to the Solar Fit Renewable Energy Show. My goodness, another beautiful day in Florida. We have actually had some crazy weather here. There's a front that kind of stalled over the top of us. Now it's moving up. I guess it's all the way up into Wisconsin now, headed toward Canada, which is a little bit on the crazy side. But I've got some excellent news today. I've got my friend Jack Kerfoot, who hasn't been on the show in about a year or so. Lots happened since then. He's a scientist, energy expert, and the author of Fueling America, An Insider's Journey. Jack, welcome to the show.
Bill, it's a pleasure to be on your program again.
Yeah, this is really cool. I think the last time we talked, I said, let's get together again. I can't believe it's been a whole year.
Wow. Yeah, time does fly, and now we've had the pandemic, and the world is even more chaotic than it was before.
I know. It is just crazy. So you are in Oregon right now?
That's correct, in Portland, Oregon.
Portland. What's it like out there?
Well, for us, it's actually quite a normal time of spring and early summer. Our temperatures are in the 60s. We get a very occasional rain, but the climate here is just marvelous. Typically, we are expecting the summer temperatures not to get over maybe the high 80s. So our summers are very mild, and our winters are mild too. So it's a wonderful part of our country to live in, and of course, it's quite green with all the pine trees up here.
You know, Jack, we're so fortunate when we think about it. America is such a beautiful country, every part of it. You're out there in a part of the country that I love because of the mountains and the streams and everything. And we're down here on the beachfront where it couldn't be better. We're just very, very fortunate to live in this great country.
Indeed.
Indeed. So, Jack, gosh darn, tell us a little bit again about your background, because I know we've got some new listeners since last year. Tell us about where you grew up and how you got involved.
Well, actually, I grew up in Oklahoma, in Tulsa, which was up until maybe the 60s, the oil capital of the United States. And then after high school, I worked and then went into the Army, served in Vietnam, came back and started my education at the University of Oklahoma on the GI Bill, graduated in degrees in geophysics in 1976, and that's when America was going through a different type of energy crisis. 1973, there'd been the oil embargo. Oil prices had gone from $8 a barrel up to $35, $36 a barrel, and ultimately hit almost $40 a barrel in 1980. So I went to work for an oil company. The idea was trying to help or serve my country or help my country find oil to keep our economy going. We have to realize in those days the cost of capital or to borrow from money from the bank was 18-19%, and our economy was teetering because of the high price of oil and the shortage of oil as well and energy. So that took me around the world, working in all every continent in the world except for Antarctica, working with ministers and scientists and sheiks and even heads of state, looking for new reserves, looking at different challenges, and the niche that I developed was turnarounds and startup of operations and companies. I retired, well, semi-retired 2 years ago and wrote my book, Fueling America, An Insider's Journey. And I wrote it simply to try and explain how the evolution of energy in our country has changed over the last 150, 200 years. And it's important to recognize that we hear so many people talk about energy, so it's a very frequently discussed topic, but unfortunately it's a very poorly understood topic, especially by many of our politicians that sometimes grab headlines and really don't understand the details of the changes that have gone in our country. So that's why I wrote the book. We have to realize that 15 years ago, over 50% of our power was generated from coal. In April, that was April of 2005. In April last year, 2019, coal generated only 22% of our power, and renewables had passed that to 23%. Renewables are continuing to grow and are projected to actually be 35-40% of our nation's power source within the next 5 or so years. And the reason for that is multifold. First of all, cost. The cheapest form of power without any subsidies is onshore wind at about 5.2 cents per kilowatt hour. compare that to the average price of power in the United States, which is about 12.6, 12.7 cents per kilowatt hour. I believe in Florida, where you are, it's about 11.5 cents per kilowatt hour. And then after onshore wind, next is solar, and then hydro, and then even with the drop in the price of oil and natural gas is actually fourth. But there was, those are your four cheapest forms of power. So moving to renewable not only saves the consumer money, it also obviously have no or virtually no greenhouse gas emissions, so we have clean air. And more importantly, from national security, it will allow us to be once again energy independent and never again dependent on foreign oil imports. So from that standpoint, that's why I am an advocate for renewable energy.
Hey, Jack, let's take a trip backwards, because I'm sure there's some people in the listening audience that really aren't as old as you and I. It sounds like you and I are about in the same generation. But going back to the late 70s during this embargo, it was absolutely incredible. If you had to name Jack Kerfoot, last name with a K, you got 6 gallons of fuel on every other Thursday. I mean, it was rationing. It was unbelievable, wasn't it?
Yeah, yes, it was, and that's what people fail to recognize. And the reason for that is Israel had been attacked by Egypt and Syria, Yom Kippur War, and what had happened is the United States and a few countries like Britain and the Netherlands offered humanitarian aid, not military aid, but humanitarian aid. And as a result of that, the organization of OPEC, primarily some of the countries in the Middle East, put a ban on oil exports. So for that reason, there was literally a shortage. The United States had gone from in the 1940s, before actually the late 1930s, up and before the start of the Second World War, America had been the largest producer and exporter of oil in the world. But by 1951, we became a net importer because of the automobile. Our economy was growing, our population was growing, and more people were buying cars and consuming gasoline. So by 1951, oil was the primary fossil fuel that the world was consuming. And so by the 1970s, OPEC had gained a dominant share of production and overtaken the U.S., which had now become a net importer. And so the world economy and the world energy dynamics had changed dramatically, and we were caught unprepared. So to me, it is essential that our country develop an energy policy, not just for today, but for the long term, for our security and also for the consumer.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. And, you know, when you talk about renewable energy, the thing that's interesting is, you know, based on where you're located. So if you're in upstate New York, you know, maybe hydro is the way to go, right? You got the, you know, Niagara Falls right there produces tons and tons of free energy. And if you're out in the Midwest, maybe it's wind. If that's out where you are, maybe it's hydro. But in Florida, man, it is by far solar. But, you know, wind is another it's amazing there's not more development of wind offshore here in Florida, really.
Well, that's the thing that's just started. Of course, offshore wind in Europe has been a major source of power for over 20 years. And the reason they moved to offshore wind in Europe, quite candidly, is if you look around the wind currents around the world, the winds offshore are stronger and more consistent than they are onshore. And the speed of the wind is very critical to power capacity from a wind turbine. A speed of 14 miles an hour to 16 miles an hour, just 2 mile an hour difference, the turbine can effectively double the amount of power output capacity. So that's critical. Now, the first offshore wind farm in the U.S. was established off of Rhode Island in state waters, which typically goes from the shoreline out to 10 miles. And that was at the end of 2016. But right now, there is a major boom of development of offshore wind farms from Maine all the way down to North Carolina. And even in the Great Lakes, there's a wind farm that's being developed in Lake Erie to provide power to the city of Cleveland. Now, on the west coast of the U.S., wind is actually strongest. The strongest winds in the entire country are actually North California, but and offshore Oregon. But the West Coast states have not been as progressive as the East Coast as far as looking at offshore wind. So absolutely, wind is a dynamic source. States like, for instance, Oklahoma in the Great Plains 15 years ago had virtually no renewable energy. But by the end of 2019, about 50% of their entire power was from wind and solar. So many states, regardless of whether they're conservative or progressive, have really been making the move to renewable energy, and it has more to do with the utilities in those particular states than it does politics.
Yeah, so how do the utilities play in? Down here in Florida, we've got both FPL and Duke putting together massive solar farms. Obviously, we love to see that because we think every kilowatt that's clean is a good one. But how does the utility play with the normal commercial or household vendor?
Well, and the answer to that question is it depends on the competition. In states like Oklahoma that have a very competitive utility market, what they have is competition, and so the utilities are challenging one another to provide cost-effective, low-cost, and reliable power. When I lived in Texas, when I lived in Houston, Texas, I could literally go online and choose my power provider from a list of over 20, as I recall, 22, 24 different companies that were selling electricity at the time. And so because of that, Texas and Oklahoma have some of the lowest energy costs in the United States. Now, when we get to Oregon, we benefit from legacy hydro projects that were built in the 40s, 50s, and 60s. So for that reason, our power costs are relatively low. But the reality is we only have two utilities, PGE, Portland General Electric, and Pacific Corporation. And for that reason, they haven't been as aggressive in moving to renewable energy. 15 years ago, Oregon had about 40-45% of our power was from renewable energy. And that was almost exclusively hydro at that time. Today, we're maybe 60%. Over the last 15 years, 15-20% moving, looking at onshore wind, a bit of small amounts of geothermal, and we're developing a hybrid system, which is wind and solar combination. But we have not been making those moves. Now, the other thing that helps the utilities is state regulations relative to land access. States like Texas, which now have over 25% of the wind power in our country, have been very progressive in their movement to make it easier for utilities to have access to not only develop and set up wind farms or solar parks, but also to lay the power lines and to provide access into the major grid. In Oregon, we have a more restrictive policies, which make it very difficult for competition to set up and tie into the grid. So for that reason, that's another reason that we've been slower than other states for renewable.
Are you seeing a lot of adoption from local homeowners and business owners where they want to own their own supply?
Well, of course, now we don't have as much solar potential in the western part of the state as certainly you do down in Florida or even down in Southern California, but we do have individual homeowners that are looking at solar as an option, and particularly in eastern Oregon, we also get quite a bit of use of solar in different areas. The answer is to a degree, but again, the utilities have not been that progressive at looking at concepts like metering to allow you to not only sell your excess power back into the grid. So again, it's competition and it depends on the progress. Now, we look at states like Hawaii or Arizona or California, they've been far more progressive about allowing metering and allowing houses or even complexes, housing complexes or housing communities that are being built to not only use solar but to tie them into a power grid and to sell the power not only between other members in the community but also back into the grid as well. Again, it depends on the actual states itself.
Understand. Well, here in Florida, it's really interesting. We're seeing a a lot of people coming to the state of Florida for a variety of reasons. Of course, the weather's pretty nice, but, you know, the taxation and stuff. And I think with this pandemic that we're seeing, we're going to see more and more people come in. And, of course, I mean, that's good. We love to have the people come down. And that's why I'm a transplant from the Adirondacks many years ago, and I love it here. But, you know, the infrastructure needs to be updated. We're going to need additional electric. People are going to electric cars. And we need a lot of electricity down here, and solar can be a real driving force.
Yeah, absolutely. We've got to recognize that people think about renewable energy, and they only think about the wind turbines or the solar farms and the fact that there's electricity on their house. But the reality is the whole world is going through a transformation, an energy transformation. This is about as a dramatic revolution as it was when we went from horse-drawn carriages to electric vehicles, electric cars and trains, and ultimately planes. We're now seeing the move to electric vehicles and electrification, transportation electrification, which is quite candidly, it goes back into the move from horse-drawn carriages to electric or gasoline-powered vehicles. As an example, Amazon last year committed to buy over 100,000 electric vans, and their goal is to reduce their carbon footprint. And they're buying them from a small company in Detroit, Michigan, that has developed the expertise in developing electric trucks and vans for larger hauling, and really are recognized as a world leader. They're up in Detroit, Michigan, Rivian. Now, the company has also been heavily supported with different projects as well from companies like Ford, General Motors, Apple, and Google. So the electrification of different transportation systems is really underway. This year, assuming it haven't been slowed because of the virus, Ford was planning on coming out with the electric F-150 pickup truck, which is their most popular vehicle, and also the electric Mustang. And I'm supposed to be taking delivery of my electric Mini Cooper here once they finish building it and shipping it over from Europe.
Oh, man.
So I think we're going to see more and more changes as well. Perhaps the most startling and the most exciting aspect of this is the battery technology. Companies like Tesla, the battery distance on a single charge is about 350 miles. But new companies, American and European battery companies, are now talking about being able to extend those driving distances to over 500 miles. But more importantly, being able to go in and recharge, gain almost a complete 100% recharge on that battery in less than 5 minutes. So if you think about it, that means that the gasoline stations will be quickly converted into gasoline and recharging stations as well, because you'll drive in onto a trip and you'll be able to plug in your car, and 3 or 4 minutes later you'll be able to drive away in about the same amount of time as it takes to fill up your car with gasoline, but at significantly lower cost.
Oh, man.
The electric vehicles only have 18 moving parts, and their typical operating costs, even in states with high electricity prices, is significantly less. It's about a quarter of your annual operating cost on an electric vehicle as it is on a combustion engine vehicle.
Jeez.
So those changes are really going to make the move in America and in Europe and certainly in places like China and Japan to the electric vehicles much faster than many people expect.
Jeez. You know, Jack, I should have taken a break about 3 minutes ago, but I was so enthralled by your conversation I couldn't get it. Hey, folks, stay with us. When we come back, we're going to talk more with Jack about fueling America. We're right back with you.
Solar fit your life and set yourself free with the sun's free energy. Solar fits the way, we can show you how. Solar fit your life, the future is now. America needs free energy. Solar fit sets you free.
Hi folks, this is Bill Gallagher. Join your friends and neighbors. Solar fit your home and watch your power meter spin backwards.
Solar fit your life and set yourself free with the sun's free energy.
Hi, folks. Welcome back to the Solar Fit Renewable Energy Show. Bill Gallagher with my friend Jack Kerfoot. And if you just joined us, Jack is the energy expert and author of Fueling America, An Insider's Journey. Jack, before the break, which we went a little bit long on because I was so interested, I love this whole concept of electric cars. And, you know, it, to me, it's like a Wood Brothers pit stop. You pull into the gas station, the battery drops down, another pops up like that, and you're on the road after a quick cup of coffee. I mean, how does it get better than that?
Well, it doesn't. You know, what I find, again, this is part of sometimes people making assumptions will say, oh, the oil companies won't let this happen. Well, actually, the oil companies are at the forefront to trying to make this happen. In Europe, most of the stations now are called fueling stations, which means they have both gasoline, diesel, and charging stations as well. And so you're actually seeing companies like British Petroleum, ExxonMobil, Chevron, Total, the French National Energy Company, that are developing, spending billions of dollars every year on different types of charging systems, and quite candidly, also the battery systems as well. And from their standpoint, you have to realize when you go for a gas station in America right now, 85% to 90% of the revenue that's generated from those stations is not from gasoline. It's from the soft drinks and the munchies people buy or the lottery tickets people buy inside the kiosks. So from their standpoint, you stay an extra minute or two, that's some more things you can buy. So they see no loss at all and just more an opportunity to keep providing the primary source of revenue, which is the soft drinks and the munchies that people buy when they get their vehicles fueled, whether it's by electricity or by gasoline. So we've got to recognize that also the oil and gas companies over the last decade have been moving into renewable energy as well, in offshore wind farms and even in solar parks in some areas and also onshore wind farms. The oil and gas companies, particularly the larger ones, have unique expertise in offshore wind platform design and offshore operations. They're very efficient and leading in technology in offshore marine design. So they are leading some of the developments in not only the platform design, but also floating wind turbines. They've had floating production, oil and gas production platforms for 15, 20 years, out to water depths of over 9,000 feet. And the further offshore you go, typically the stronger and more consistent winds you get. So what they're able to do is provide a floating platform for these wind turbines. And a floating platform is far cheaper than a fixed platform from that standpoint. And they've been operating in places like the Gulf of Mexico, like I say, for over 20 years. And when we talk about severe weather, we have to recognize the Gulf of Mexico annually gets anywhere from 3 to 5 or sometimes 6 or 7 major hurricanes going through there. And when they do, there's no real loss of equipment or damage to the equipment. They know how to shut down the particular facility or particular structure even in the deep water. So that's an exciting new development as well. And when we can extend and start to get the offshore wind development in the United States, we'll continue to see utilities making the move from coal, which is actually the most expensive form of power right now, is nuclear, at about probably 5, sometimes 6 times the cost of wind, sometimes 7 times the cost of wind, followed by coal. And what's happened with coal is the highest quality coal has been mined out. So by that, what's happened is it now takes more coal to generate the same amount of power. So the cheap form of coal that they're using now typically costs about $2.50, $3 a ton. But to ship it by rail is about $12 to $13 a ton. So for that reason, the actual cost of power from the use of coal is about 20-25% per kilowatt hour compared to 5 cents per kilowatt hour for onshore wind, or 5.3 cents for solar. So we have to expect that the utilities, because state utility boards, they look at two things when they look at new power plant proposals. Reliability, is it a reliable, sustainable power source? And is there enough energy in the area to make sure, whether it's wind or whether it's coal or natural gas, that there is sufficient, adequate supplies to maintain this power plant for the consumer? And two, cost. And so for that reason, that's why utilities across the United States have been making the move from coal and even nuclear to low-cost, clean, green energy, wind and solar and hydro from that standpoint. So, again, exciting times, and we're seeing our country make a major transformation as well in our types of energy that we're using.
You know, you brought up an important point, and it brought me back to a story that I heard in the early 1900s. There was like 100,000 people working in New York City in the horse market, either cleaning up after the horse or whatever, and it took about 3 years. It dropped from 100,000 to 10,000 when the automobile came out. So these transitions happen. They're not generational. They just happen as things develop. But we're in the middle of it right now.
Yeah, absolutely. And people will say, like, for instance, in some areas, some people argue in coal, like producing states, it's taking jobs away. The actual fact is it isn't, because as we all know, no fossil fuel is not renewable. Coal plants get mined out. The coal gets mined out, or the oil field that produces the actual oil is depleted and eventually are closed, shut in. So what we have now is, because there's actually a shortage of technicians to work on these solar parks and wind farms, we have a critical shortage of resources, technical resources, people. And so what the energy companies are doing, the wind farms and the solar parks are doing, are actively going out recruiting people from the coal industry and the coal mines to come work for them. They've been trained to operate major power source or power operations, which a lot of those skills can be directly applied over to the wind farm or the solar park. They also have been trained in safe operations and procedures, which is very important for any operation. So they're very highly sought after. And from the coal worker standpoint, they go from a job that they know will only last as long as coal is economic to a job that will last as long as the wind is blowing. So for them, it's job security, and it's job security for future generations in the state as well. So the advantages of making the move to renewable energy are many, multifold, both from the employee, for the unions, for the consumer, from the prices, and for the clean air that we have, and of course, national energy security, I keep coming back to me, is paramount in our thought processes.
For sure, and from a health standpoint, the unintended consequences of burning coal is pretty obvious after seeing what happened with the shutdown in China and having things clear up. We only got a couple minutes left. Jack, I want to ask you a question about where we are from a political standpoint up in Washington. What's going on up there?
Well, sometimes I have to wonder myself. There are certainly some interesting standpoints, positions people are taking. We're seeing, unfortunately, people trying to politicize energy from a lot of different reasons. We have, of course, the president taking the position of pro-coal and making statements like wind turbines create cancer, which is not true. And then on the other side, we have people like Representative Ocasio-Cortez, who says we should be 100% renewable energy in 10 years. Well, the reality is we can't get there even if we snapped our fingers. For a lot of reasons, the technology could probably get us up to 80%. We also have to look at how we transition in a way that we don't have power outages. We don't want to shut down the power to hospitals and to homes and to schools. So we need people that can be more balanced from that standpoint. Now, the good news is you are seeing people looking at bipartisan proposals, and hopefully after this upcoming election, we will be able to get a Congress bipartisan efforts to make positive changes toward renewable energy. There are several positive from both Republican and Democrat senators and House of Representatives that want to see more changes made relative to the power grid to make it more sustainable and more secure, and also to encourage the continued development of renewable energy, onshore wind, and also looking at other sources as well, like tidal energy.
Really, and now we're down to 1 minute, but I got to throw in a little bit of a climate issue here, because we're down in Florida, we're seeing the tides rise, and I think anything we can do individually or on a corporate level to stem that, regardless of what's causing it, is worthwhile. Wouldn't you agree?
Absolutely. And the U.S. Military, the Department of Navy, is particularly concerned because that's impacting their naval bases around the world. So, yes, absolutely. It's a factor we must consider and recognize the ramifications of climate change.
So, Jack, we're about out of time. I want to ask you if we can do this again before another year, because you've got your finger on the pulse of what's going on. What an awesome job you're doing out there.
Well, thank you very much, and it would be my pleasure. Anytime, Bill, it would be absolutely a pleasure to be on your program again.
Well, we would love having you, Jack. You're such a source of knowledge, and keep up the great work out there. Well, folks, that about does it for us today. We're going to sign off for now. Have a wonderful weekend. Be safe out there, and I hope you enjoyed everything that Jack had to share with us, and we'll talk to you again next week. Bye-bye.
SolarFit Renewable Energy Radio Show, paid for by SolarFit.